So imagine that you are in command of the state apparatus. And the state is defined as an institution that possesses, on the one hand, a territorial monopoly of ultimate decision-making in every case of conflict, including conflicts involving the state and the operators of the state itself. And second part of the definition, the state is then by implication an institution that has the right to tax, that is, to unilaterally determine the price that the state's subjects must pay to the state to perform this task of ultimate decision-making. Now, to act under these constraints, or rather under this lack of any constraints, is what constitutes politics and political action. And it should be clear from the outset that politics, and by its very nature, always means mischief. Not from your point of view. Remember, you are in charge of the state. You run the state. Not from your point of view, of course, but mischief from the point of view of those that are subject to your rule as the ultimate judge in every case of conflict. Predictably, you will use your position to enrich yourself at other people's expense. More specifically, we can predict in particular what your attitude and policy vis-a-vis money and banking will be. Assume that you rule over a territory that has developed beyond the stage of a primitive barter economy, and where there is a common medium of exchange that is a money in existence. First off, it is easy to see why you would be particularly interested in money and monetary affairs. As a state ruler, you can in principle confiscate whatever you want and provide yourself with an unearned income. But rather than confiscating various producer or consumer goods, you will naturally prefer to confiscate money, because money, as the most easily and widely saleable and acceptable good of all goods, allows you then the greatest freedom to spend your income as you happen to like it, on the greatest variety of goods. First and foremost, then, the taxes you impose on society will be money taxes, whether on property or on income. And you will want to maximize your money tax revenue. Now, in this attempt, however, you will quickly encounter some rather intractable difficulties. Eventually, your attempts to further increase your tax income will encounter resistance, in that higher tax rates will not lead to higher but to lower tax revenue that you collect. Your income, that is, your spending money, declines because producers burdened with increasingly higher tax rates simply produce less. In this situation, you only have one other option to further increase or at least maintain your current level of spending, namely by borrowing funds. And for that, you must go to banks. And hence, your special interest also in banks and the banking industry. If you borrow money from banks, these banks will automatically take an active interest in your own future well-being. That is, they will want you to stay in business, and that is to say, they want the state to go on in its exploitation business. And since banks tend to be major players in society, such support is certainly beneficial to you. On the other hand, as a negative, if you borrow money from banks, You are not only expected to pay back your loan, but you are also expected to pay interest on top. The question then that arises for you as a state ruler is this: how can I free myself of these two constraints? First, of the constraint of tax resistance in the form of lower or falling tax revenue, and the second constraint of the need to borrow from and pay interest to banks. Now, I suggest that it is not too difficult to see what the ultimate solution to your problem, the problem of the state, is. You can reach the desired independence of taxpayers and tax payments and of banks if only you establish yourself first as a territorial monopolist of the production of money by saying, on my territory, only I am permitted to produce money. But that is not sufficient, because as long as money is a regular good that must be expensively produced, there is nothing in it for you except expenses. More importantly is then that you must use your monopoly position in order to lower the production cost and the quality of money as close as possible to zero. Instead of costly quality money such as gold or silver, you must see to it that worthless pieces of paper that can be produced practically at zero cost will become money. In parentheses, normally, of course, no one would accept, you have heard that repeatedly, no one would, of course, accept worthless pieces of paper as payment for anything. Pieces of paper are acceptable as payments only insofar as they are, and that's what they initially were, as they are titles to something else, namely they function as property titles. In other words, then, you must replace pieces of paper that were titles to real money with pieces of paper that are titles to absolutely nothing. Now, under competitive conditions, if everyone could produce this type of paper money, a money that can be produced at almost zero cost would be produced up to a quantity where marginal revenue equals marginal cost. And since marginal cost is zero, the marginal revenue, that is, the purchasing power of money, would be zero as well. Hence, the necessity to monopolize the production of paper money so as to restrict its supply in order to avoid hyperinflationary conditions and the disappearance of money from the market altogether, and the flight into real values. And the necessity to monopolize this is, of course, the greater, the cheaper, the lower quality money we have in front of us. In a way, you have thus accomplished what all alchemists and their sponsors wanted to achieve. You have produced something valuable, something with purchasing power, out of something that is practically worthless. What an achievement this is. It costs you practically nothing, and you can turn around and buy yourself something really valuable, such as a house or a Mercedes or a BMW, and you can achieve these wonders not just for yourself, but also for your friends and acquaintances, of which you discover that you have far more than you had known before, including, of course, many economists who explain why your monopoly is really good for everyone. Now, what are the effects of this? First and foremost, more paper money does not in the slightest affect the quantity or quality of all other non-monetary goods in existence. There exist just as many other goods around as before. Now this immediately refutes the notion that is apparently held by most, if not all, contemporary mainstream economists, namely that more money can somehow increase social wealth. To believe this, as everyone proposing so-called easy money policies as efficient ways and socially responsible ways out of economic troubles apparently does, is to believe in magic, namely that stones, or rather paper, can be turned into bread. Again, let me emphasize that I have the impression that there are practically no economists around nowadays who dispute that almost all economists nowadays tend to believe in this magic, that more paper can heal economic crisis. They have not grown beyond the age of kindergarten children. Even they might see through this. Rather, what the additional money you printed will affect is twofold. On the one hand, money prices will be higher than they would be otherwise, and the purchasing power per unit of money will be lower. Or in a word, the result will be inflation. More importantly, however, all the while, the greater amount of money does not increase the total amount of presently existing social wealth, that is, the total quantity of all goods in society. It redistributes the existing wealth in favor of you and your friends and acquaintances, that is, those who get your money first. You and your friends are relatively enriched. You own a larger part of social wealth now, at the expense of impoverishing others, those who own less, and those other people who receive the money, the newly created money, later or last. The problem for you and your friends with this institutional setup is not that it doesn't work. It works perfectly, always to your own and your friends' advantage, and always at the expense of others. All you have to do is to avoid hyperinflation. For in that case, of course, people would avoid using money altogether and flee into real values, and thereby you would be robbed of your magic wand that you control. The problem with your paper money monopoly, if there is one at all, is only that this fact will be immediately noticed also by others and recognized as a big criminal ripoff that it indeed is. But this problem can be overcome too. If, in addition to monopolizing the production of money, you also set yourself up as a banker and enter the banking business with the establishment of a central bank. Because you can create paper money out of thin air, you can also create credit out of thin air. In fact, because you can create credit out of nothing, that is, without any savings on your part, you can offer loans at cheaper rates than anyone else, even at interest rates as low as zero. With this ability, not only is your former dependency on banks and the banking industry eliminated, moreover, you can make banks dependent on you, and you can forge a permanent alliance and complicity between banks and state. You don't even have to become involved in the business of investing the credit yourself. That task and the risk involved in it, you can safely leave to the commercial banks. What you, your central bank, need to do is only this. You create credit out of thin air and then loan this money at below market interest rates to commercial banks. Instead of you paying interest to banks, banks now pay interest to you. And the banks, in turn, loan out your newly created easy credit to their business friends at somewhat higher but still at sub-market interest rates to earn from the interest differential. In addition, to make the banks especially keen on working with you, you may permit the banks to create a certain amount of their own new credit, of new checkbook money, in addition and on top of the credit that you have created out of thin air. This is the fractional reserve banking system that we have to live with. Now, what are the consequences of this monetary policy? To a large extent, they are the same as with an easy money policy. First, an easy credit policy is also inflationary. More money is brought into circulation, and prices will be higher, and the purchasing power of money will be lower than would be the case otherwise. And second, the credit expansion too has no effect on the quantity or quality of all goods currently in existence. It neither increases nor decreases their amount. More money is just this, more paper. It does not and cannot increase social wealth by one iota. And third, easy credit also engenders a systematic redistribution of social wealth in favor of you, namely the central bank, and the commercial banks within your banking cartel. You receive an interest return on money that you have created at practically zero cost out of thin air, instead of on money that you had to costly save first. And so do the banks, who earn additional interest on your costless money loans. Both you and your banker friends thereby appropriate an unearned income. You and the banks are enriched at the expense of all real money savers, those who receive a lower interest return than they otherwise would have received, that is, without the injection of your and the bank's cheap credit into the credit market. On the other hand, there also exists a fundamental difference between an easy print and spend money policy and an easy print and loan credit policy. First off, an easy credit policy alters the production structure, has an effect on what is produced and by whom in a highly significant way. You, that is, the chief of the central bank, can create credit out of thin air. You do not have to first save money out of a given income. That is, you do not have to cut your current expenses and thus abstain from buying certain non-money goods, as every normal person, of course, must if he extends credit to someone else. You only have to turn on the printing press and can thus undercut any interest rate demanded of borrowers by savers elsewhere in the market. Granting credit does not involve any sacrifice on your part, which is why this institution is, of course, so nice. If things then go well, you will be paid a positive interest return on your paper investment. And if they don't go well, as a monopoly producer of money, you can always make up losses more easily than anyone else, namely by covering your losses with even more printed paper. And without costs and no genuine personal risk of losses then, you can grant credit essentially indiscriminately to everyone and for any purpose without concern for the creditworthiness or creditworthiness of the debtor or the soundness of his business plan. Because of your easy credit, certain people, in particular investment bankers, who otherwise would not be deemed sufficiently creditworthy, and certain projects, in particular projects of banks and of their main clients, that would not be considered profitable but wasteful or too risky, Instead, they do get credit and do get funded. Essentially, the same applies to the commercial banks within your banking cartel. Because of their special relationship to you as the first recipients of your costless low-interest paper money credit, the banks too can offer loans to prospective lenders at interest rates below market interest rates. And if things go well for them, they go well. And if they don't, they can rely on you again as a monopolistic producer of money, that you will bail them out in the same way as you would bail out yourself out of any financial trouble, namely buy more paper money. Accordingly, the banks also will be less discriminating in the selection of their clients and their business plans, and more prone to funding the wrong people and the wrong projects. And there's a second significant difference between a print and spend and a print and loan policy. And this difference explains why the income and wealth redistribution in your and your banker friend's favor that is set in motion by easy credit takes the specific form of a temporal boom-bust cycle. That is, of an initial phase of seeming general prosperity, of expected increases in future incomes and wealth, followed by a phase of widespread impoverishment when the prosperity of the boom period is revealed as a widespread illusion. Now, this boom-bust feature is a logical and physically necessary consequence of credit created out of thin air, of credit unbacked by savings, or, as Mises says, of fiduciary credit, and of the fact that every investment takes time and only shows on later in time, at some time in the future, whether it is successful or not. The reason for the business cycle is in a way as elementary as it is fundamental. Imagine Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe can give a loan of fish, which he has not consumed, to Friday. Friday then converts these savings into a fishing net. He can eat the fish while constructing the net. And with the help of the net, then, Friday, in principle, is capable of repaying his loan to Robinson, plus interest, and still, for himself, earn a profit of additional fish for himself. But all of this is physically impossible if Robinson's loan is only a paper note denominated in fish, but unbacked by any real fish savings. That is, if Robinson has no fish because he himself has already consumed it all, then, and necessarily so, Friday must fail in his investment endeavor. Now, in a simple barter economy, of course, this becomes immediately apparent. Friday would simply not accept Robinson's paper credit in the first place, but he would only accept real commodity credit, namely real fish. And because of this, the boom-bust cycle will not get started in a simple, primitive barter economy. But in a complex monetary economy, the fact that credit was created out of thin air is not immediately noticeable. Every credit note looks like any other. And because of this, the notes are accepted by the takers of credit without any problem. This does not change the fundamental fact of reality, however, that nothing can be produced out of nothing. And that investment projects undertaken without any real funding Any funding whatsoever by previous savings must fail. But it explains why a boom, that is an increased level of investment accompanied by the expectation of higher future income and wealth, can get started. Friday does accept the note instead of immediately refusing it. And it explains why it then takes a while until the physical reality reasserts itself and reveals such as expectations as illusionary. But what is a little crisis to you? Even if your path to riches is through repeated crises brought about by your paper money regime and central bank policies, from your point of view, that is, from the viewpoint as a head of state and the chief of the central bank, this form of print and loan wealth redistribution in your and your banker's friend's favor, while it is less immediate than that achieved with a simple print and spend policy, is still much to be preferred, because it is far more difficult to see through and recognize for what it actually is. Rather than coming across as a plain fraud and parasite, in pursuing an easy credit policy, you can even pretend that you are engaged in the selfless task of investing in the future. Of course, always for the good of our children. Rather than spending on present frivolities. And you can pretend that you are actually healing the economy from economic crisis, rather than being responsible for causing these crises. Now, what a world this is in which we live. And I can only end by saying the Mises Institute is not an institute that is interested in public policy, making proposals to politicians what they should do and what they shouldn't do, and cozying up to those in power. The achievement of the Mises Institute is to enlighten us, to make us understand how the world works, and to give us enjoyment in being able to say, I understand now what is going on in this world. And if this type of enlightenment and this enjoyment in knowledge is something that you appreciate, then I can only ask you to please be generous to the Institute, donate money to the Institute. I'm not on the payroll of the Mises Institute, so I'm not pleading my own case. I'm pleading the case of mankind and its interest in knowledge and the enjoyable experience of knowing something, understanding something, and being able also to laugh about the idiocy of the world that we inhabit. Thank you very much.